Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Can your savings weather an economic storm? There are very few physical assets you can invest in that are proven to stand the test of time. Gold has withstood as a valued form of money for millennia, and Birch Gold lets you convert a retirement account into a tax-sheltered IRA and physical gold that doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. Text COAST to 989898 and claim your free info kit on gold. Text COAST to 989898 and secure your savings today.
Now here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Chuck Gunderson with us. Was raised in San Diego, the site of the Beatles' eighth stop on their 1965 North American tour. He was a little too young to attend the show, but fondly recalls his older siblings spinning the records of the Fab Four as he grew, which perked a lifelong love for the band. He has worked in the outdoor advertising industry most of his life, although his true compassion is history, having published a few articles over the years. Chuck turned his sights to researching and writing the critically acclaimed Some Fun Tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours of 1964 to 66. He has consulted on a number of various Beatles-related subjects and projects, such as director Ron Howard's recent documentary, 8 Days a Week, as well. Chuck, thank you for joining us. I can't believe it's been 40 years since we've lost John Lennon.
George, hello, how are you? It's so good to be on. And when you play that little clip of Howard Cosell announcing the terrible event that happened in New York City that night, it just brought back a flood of memories.
Chilly. What got into, and Mark David Chapman is 65 now, he's still in prison, he comes up for parole, it gets denied, and what compelled him to do this? I thought he was a fan of John Lennon.
Yes, but as you know, some fans they also turn violent, and it happened that night. It was a terrible event. I don't know, George. I don't know if you remember where you were at, but I certainly remember where I was at. I was 18 years old, and I was sitting on our couch in our family room watching Monday Night Football. The field goal kicker was lining up for a kick, and Cosell interrupted that to tell the news. And what's interesting is if you go onto YouTube, there's an amazing clip of the broadcast crew, including Don Meredith, talking about if they should announce it on the air. And they were kind of debating if they should or not. And Cosell was actually kind of against it. And it was actually, I believe, Frank Gifford who convinced Cosell to announce it, because it was so paramount to announce and to give the world that news. But it was surreal, George. I was sitting on the couch and, you know, just enjoying Monday Night Football as a young kid. And you know, I'd loved the Beatles all my life. And to hear that, it just set me into utter shock.
Oh, my gosh.
I just couldn't even believe it.
I was in St. Louis at the time running a news department. I'm in St. Louis right now. But I was there in the newsroom when we were an NBC station, but we had all the networks up on different TV screens. And I heard the Cosell remark, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, it was, and then our wire machines were going off. They kept dinging, you know, ding, ding. And you'd look at the wire machines from the Associated Press or United Press International, and it showed that he had been shot and was killed. It was a shocker.
Yeah, and to go back to your first question about these, you know, there are obsessive fans. I mean, there's a history of them. I mean, we have people that have done this in the past to several superstars in the music industry and, you know, the acting world. I mean, look at, the person that tried to assassinate President Reagan, who had this fascination with Jodie Foster. I mean, it's just part of the fandom, and I think that is why, you know, security now is so much higher than it was, you know, when the Beatles toured around the world. You know, even though they required 150 policemen to be there, there's still situations where fans could get to them.
Mark David Chapman has been denied parole 11 times, and he had earlier refused requests for interviews, but has said that he did not kill John Lennon for fame or notoriety. He just went into that and did what he did. If you had a chance to interview him, Chuck, what would you first ask him? I guess it would be why.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, you want to get into his head of, you know, why he did it. I don't even know really if I'd, you know, even as a historian, George, and I know other of my colleagues who study and follow the Beatles, you know, some have said they would love to go in and interview him. I would have a little bit of trepidation doing it. I mean, he just took the life of such a beautiful man who gave so much in so short of a time. And I mean, 40 years, George, that's it. I'm well past that. To take the life of someone that was so gifted, so talented, just so unusually bright, and gave the world so much, and was willing to give the world a lot more. It would be a hard thing for me to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was given 20 years to life, and as I mentioned, he's been denied parole 11 times. A lot of people might not know this, Chuck, but Mark David Chapman contemplated killing other public figures. He was thinking about killing Johnny Carson, Paul McCartney, Ronald Reagan at the time as well. He had no prior criminal convictions, and he had just resigned from a job as a security guard in Hawaii when he made his way to New York. Just a shocker.
It's terrible to think of those people who are lurking around who kind of go unnoticed. And I think that's why security has gotten so much more strict now. Boy, when you go, you know, to a concert or you're near the red carpet of any sort, I mean, there's people watching, there's people checking you for firearms or any kind of threats. A lot more now than there was back then.
Oh, yeah. You get patted down in some places, too, now these days.
Exactly.
Well, let's talk about some fun things about the life of John Lennon and the rest of the Beatles. I remember back in 1964 when they first appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. I was just a little teenager at the time, but they had 73 million people watching television that night. Absolutely unheard of.
Yeah, it was a television record at that point. A lot of people think that they kind of, you know, rose to fame right then and there before our eyes. But in reality, you know, they had worked very, very hard in their native Britain to get where they were to, you know, even be invited on the Sullivan Show. You were lucky to possibly watch him there, George, on TV. It's interesting. I was born in 1962, so it's about a year and a half, so I don't remember.
Yeah,
that.
You were too little. I was.
Yeah, my family telling me about it. So I call myself not a first-generation fan like you are. I call myself a Generation 1.5 fan. You know, I really discovered the Beatles in the 70s, going to school and having friends that liked the Beatles. That's when they burst onto the scene here in America, was that February 9th performance on the Ed Sullivan Show in front of 73 million people. One in four television sets in America were turned on that day.
And Ed got him back two more times. He got him for three total times, and he got him cheap, too. Normally, he would give $10,000 to one performance to some person or group. He got them for $3,500 a night.
Amazing. You know, Ed drove a hard bargain, but I think the Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, was even smarter in saying, look at the exposure we're going to get. We're going to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, but, you know, Brian was also savvy as well. And one of the things that kind of Mr. Sullivan didn't like too much about Brian was that Epstein wanted the Beatles to have top billing on the Ed Sullivan Show that night. I mean, that was kind of unheard of. I mean, you had other bigger star, Mitzi Gaynor, things like that. So, you know, it was a good deal for both of them, for both Sullivan and, of course, you know, Brian Epstein and his band, the Beatles.
Was it Elvis Presley who really was obsessed with the Beatles, or the Beatles with Presley?
Oh, it was the Beatles with Presley. I mean, they fell in love with him in when they were all in Liverpool. I mean, Paul often talks about hearing the song All Shook Up, and, you know, it just sent him. And what's really interesting, George, is I've got a good friend in Dallas, Texas. You won't believe this, but he actually has the physical record, All Shook Up, that John Lennon listened to. He would go over to his friend's house.
Wow.
And listen to this record. And my friend in Dallas was actually able to get that record, and so he has that original record that Paul listened to over there.
Well, here's a funny story for you, Chuck. In St. Louis, years ago, I used to own a small video production company which did commercials and industrials for corporations and things like that. And one day, somebody just walked into the office and had a tape in his hand and was just walking around looking for a machine to play the tape in our video production studio. And I'm going, who is this guy walking around? It was Chuck Berry.
Yeah, the Beatles loved all the early rock and roll pioneers, Elvis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Carl Perkins, you know, all the Motown girl groups. I mean, they loved them all, and they cut their teeth on it. And the Beatles were the best at taking that American music and repackaging it and
yep.
then singing it their way and selling it. And they did a phenomenal job.
Well, the song Till There Was You, which was in the musical The Music Man, was an old-time classic. And when I heard the Beatles do it, I thought that was theirs.
Exactly. And they actually did it on the Ed Sullivan Show on that second performance in Miami when they were playing at the Deauville Hotel. Which was a really rendition of that, really nice rendition of that song. And I think Paul McCartney just sang it beautifully.
Now, they toured three times in the United States and North America. And if I remember, they hit some stadiums, packed crowds, right?
Yeah, that didn't really happen until it started in the 1965 tour when they played Shea Stadium in New York. That was a absolute sellout crowd. 55,600 people were there that night. And they were starting to attract bigger crowds. In 1964, you know, Brian Epstein didn't want them to play in big stadiums. He didn't feel they were quite ready yet. He didn't want to wanted people to kind of want more. So in 65 and 66, they accepted engagements in larger cities. And in your St. Louis area there, George, they played Busch Stadium on
August
21st, 66.
The original Busch Stadium before they knocked it down.
The original Busch Stadium, yes.
That is something. It was dramatic. I remember my dad talking about their haircuts, Chuck. And all adults were freaking out about those haircuts because they knew that we were going to start growing our hair a little longer and a little longer. And every time I now look at pictures of the Beatles, the four of them, with this bowl-cut haircut, I went, God, that didn't look good at all. But, I mean, that was the craze.
Yeah, shocking at the time. I mean, everybody just thought their hair was so long. And actually, journalists at press conferences when they'd tour in America, they'd ask the serious question. They said, "Is your hair real?" I mean, they really thought they were wigs. And of course, the Beatles kind of took that look from their time when they're doing gigs in Germany in the early days, in the very early 60s. Kind of got that look from some of the German friends that they had over there at the time.
I had a friend who passed away a couple of years ago. He was in Los Angeles. He was a record producer, Russ Regan. And he discovered Neil Diamond, Elton John, and the Beach Boys. And when he found the Beach Boys, they were called the Pendletons. They were named after a sweater. And Reagan said, no, you are now the Beach Boys, and changed their name, and it was dramatic. How did the Beatles, do you know, how did the Beatles get their name?
Well, in Liverpool, where they were playing, there was a craze called the skiffle music, which, you know, after the war, there wasn't a lot of instruments around. You couldn't just, you know, go. I mean, they're expensive as well. You're
sure.
Talking about, you know, post-war Britain here, especially in the northern territory, you know, just, you know, rough and tumble town. So they would, kids would get washboards and T-chest bass and whatever they could find, old scrappy guitars, and they'd play this kind of skiffle music. That was kind of, you know, you would hear a guy by the name of Lonnie Donegan playing music like that. And so then they started getting into this early rock and roll and beat music, and they called it beat music. So they were, you know, thinking about that. And then John Lennon had a friend by the name of Stuart Sutcliffe. And, of course, one of the Beatles' idols here in America was Buddy Holly and the Crickets. And so John and Stu kind of thought about this name with beat in it, and, you know, and they just came up with Beatles to kind of symbolize the beat music up there in Liverpool and to kind of symbolize the crickets here in America. So obviously they spelt it B-E-A-T-L-E-S.
That's right. How soon after the Beatles did the Rolling Stones pop up?
So the Rolling Stones popped up kind of in a contemporary space with the Beatles. As a matter of fact, one of the Rolling Stones' first major hits, I Want to Be Your Man, was actually written by John Lennon and Paul McCartney.
Ah.
And the Rolling Stones were given that song to record, and of course they scored a hit with it. So, you know, the Rolling Stones were more down in the London area. The Beatles were up in the north. You know, they were friendly rivals, and but obviously the Beatles were way tops over the Rolling Stones.
And the Beatles' popularity was generally to what age bracket at the time?
Well, it's interesting because here in America, and in researching my book, Some Fun Tonight, in interviewing some of these fans over the years, I've had people tell me, you know, Chuck, I was 8 years old and my parents dropped me off at the Hollywood Bowl. They told
Whoa.
Me to come back and pick me up in 2 hours. And George, you know L.A. I know you live there.
Yeah.
You know, the Hollywood Bowl, I imagine in 64 was, you know, you probably still wouldn't let your kid run around. But, you know, it was kind of that starting about 8 years old up into the, you know, preteens and the teenage, you know, younger teenagers. That was really kind of the core audience of the Beatles at that
time. Well, now, did this core audience go to their parents and say, please buy these records for me? Because the kids, the demos, like an 8 year old, they don't have any money.
No, they don't. They don't. And, you know, it would be the rich friends that they had, or friends that had privileges that had had the records. And they went over and listened to the records. And, you know, it's interesting because you would think that, you know, records were so accessible back then. Everyone, you know, you'd think everyone had a record player, and people really didn't back then. You know, you were kind of just like the Beatles did. If you
they had radios,
you know, a really good record, they would go to someone's house or something and listen to it.
Yep, absolutely. And they had their radios. That was about it.
That was it.
Well, of course, Frank Sinatra for a while could not stand Elvis Presley because he thought that music was going to destroy his. And then, of course, the Beatles came in, and the rest is history.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern, and go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where my new podcast begins. This is Neil Strauss, host of To Live and Die in L.A., and I wanted to quickly tell you about an intense new series about a dangerous spy taught to seduce men for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, this is To Die For. To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.